So it's a real pleasure today to introduce Lam Hui from Columbia University. So Lam is a very well-known cosmologist and physicist who's done important work across a range of different areas. Lam has written some really influential papers on like dark matter, large-scale structure, reionization, modified gravity, you know, basically all the areas that our group, you know, here at Perimeter is interested in. He's also done quite, he's also done quite interesting work across a range of other areas as well beyond cosmology, including like black hole perturbations, gravitational waves, effective field theories. But specifically, Lam wrote a few years ago a paper on ultra light dark matter that spurred a huge explosion of activity in the field. And so for his colloquium today, he'll be telling us about this topic, wave dark matter. And so Lam, whenever you're ready, go ahead and take it away.
Okay, thank you, Neil. Thank you for your kind words. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I do not know what is your custom here, but I think it works best. If you have questions, you just interrupt me. I think that way it will work better. So please feel free to. I don't know whether you can just speak up, but
that's right.
Okay,
that is the custom here.
Okay, great, fantastic. So I want to talk about this subject of wave dark matter, and I have a large number of collaborators, as you can see on this slide. I think in the main part of the talk, I would say, is focused on this paper with Austin Joyce, Michael Landry, and Xinyu Li. That would be the main part of the talk. Although if we have time, we will talk about the work covered in the other papers. The introduction is basically taken from this first paper you can see with my collaborators, Jerry, Scott, and Edward. Let me also highlight one of my frequent collaborators you can see, Xinyu Li, is actually in four of these papers, and he is with you at Perimeter. So with that, let me start. And again, my slice is frozen. I'm sorry about that. Okay, good. You are all familiar with the idea of dark matter, I hope, that there is a lot of astronomical evidence for it. There are also its gravitational effects. And I think it's sufficiently familiar that I'm just going to skip this part of the motivation. So I'm going to take it for granted that there is dark matter out there. We just don't know what it is. So next slide. As I said, we have a lot of evidence for the existence of dark matter. If you are interested, I'll be happy to talk about that evidence at the end, if you want to ask me about them. We remain very ignorant about its very basic properties. For example, the mass of the constituents, right? So I put on this slide, basically this whole spectrum going all the way from 10 to the minus 22 electron volts up to basically solar mass objects. There's a very wide spectrum. And we really don't know where the actual dark matter resides in this spectrum. We could, however, ask a very simple question. What do we know? Well, we actually know the mass density in the solar neighborhood fairly well. And it's this canonical number, 0.3 GeV per centimeter cubed. Given that number, we could at least put one mass scale on this vast spectrum by asking the following question. And the question is this: at what mass would the interparticle separation, the average separation, be less than the Broglie wavelength associated with that particle? The Broglie wavelength, as you might recall, depends on velocity. It's 1 over mv. Velocity here, we take it to be the velocity dispersion of the Milky Way. So it's something like 200 kilometers per second, okay? So with the known dark matter density in the solar neighborhood, we can ask this question, and if you do the math, you would decide that there is actually a special mass scale, and that mass scale is basically to the left of this arrow, Anything lighter than 30 electron volts would be in what I would call the wave regime, in the following sense, that you are in a regime like basically this sphere. Think of this sphere as the Broglie sphere, if you want. And within the Broglie sphere, there are multiple particles. In fact, if it's very light, then there are many, many particles within that Broglie sphere. By construction, this could only happen if the particle is a boson. So this is what I'm going to assume. Fermions, you know, by the exclusion principle, cannot have multiple occupancy. So this is a bosonic particle. In particular, we're going to focus on a scalar particle. And I call it the wave regime. And the way to think about this is fairly analogous to the way we think about electromagnetism. If you have a state in which you have a high occupancy, at least for many situations, the quantum fluctuations are unimportant. You can ignore it. But you can describe what is going on basically using classical fields, in particular classical waves. So this is what I mean by wave regime. Now, in the rest of this talk, I'll be talking about basically classical waves. In this case, it's dark matter waves. And to give you a sense of scale, I just list a few numbers here. No, I list the Broglie scale for different particle mass, again, assuming the velocity is 200 kilometers per second. For the lightest masses, that scale can be very big, astronomically big, and that regime is often called fuzzy dark matter. In this talk, if we are in that regime, I'll use the term ultralight. That is around 10 to the minus 22 or thereabout. But I want to emphasize, for most of this talk, you don't have to be ultralight. Basically, anything lighter than 30 electron volts, most of this talk would actually apply. And it includes, for example, a lot of QCD axion experiments look at a mass, they are about 10 to the minus 6 electron volts. So it would apply to that case as well. The Broglie wavelength, you can actually work it out. It's not that small. It's some fraction of a kilometer.
So can you say why you fixed the dark matter velocity to be 200 kilometers per second?
Good. Thanks for asking. So I'm using the velocity dispersion of the Milky Way, basically, or the solar neighborhood, and that is about 200 kilometers per second. Obviously, if you look at a different environment, you should use a different velocity.
Okay, so different galaxies should have different.
Exactly. So if you look at, for example, a dwarf galaxy, which has much lower velocity dispersion, then the Broglie wavelength will be larger. Yeah, absolutely. So here I'm just using the Milky Way number. Thanks for asking. Okay. So here is an outline of the talk. I want to spend maybe 5 minutes talking about the particle physics motivations. Why do we want to think about a light dark matter particle to begin with, in particular a bosonic particle? Why do we want to think about that? So 5 minutes of that. Most of the talk, I will talk about actually how the wave dynamics works and what does that imply about phenomenology. So that will be the bulk of the talk. And then I think I would close with some thoughts about what it implies for astrophysical observations. Those are mostly relevant if your dark matter is in fact in the ultralight end of the spectrum. And I would close with discussions for axion detection experiments. And those typically, the dark matter mass of interest is not in the ultralight regime. It's light, but not ultralight. And once again, I give this kind of 10 to the 6, 10 to the minus 6, and 10 to the minus 22 as just two kind of sample numbers to keep in mind. And in the ultralight regime, as I said, is often referred to as fuzzy dark matter, following the terminology introduced by Hooper, Khanna, and Grusinov. Okay, so let's start with the particle physics motivation. Here, I will actually be pretty brief as well. A natural candidate for a light scalar particle would be some sort of a Nambu-Goldstone boson. It's actually a pseudo Nambu-Goldstone boson because in the end, we're interested in a particle that's not actually massless. And to remind you how that works, I draw this little Mexican head potential here. hopefully that's pretty familiar to most of you, that the mass second-hand potential tells you there is some kind of U1 symmetry. The Goldstone boson is basically related to the excitation going around this circle down here, and I call it phi. Written as such, this phi, which is going to play a major role for the rest of the talk, is kind of like an angle. It's an angular field going around. The U1 symmetry, in some cases, is not exact. It's actually approximate. So this masculine potential is not completely flat, it's slightly tilted. And so there is actually a small mass associated with that. The most well-known example is, at least in the dark matter field, is the QCD axion, motivated by the strong CP problem. The fact that the measurements of the neutron electric dipole moment give very strong bounds, and that is a well-known problem, and the axion is a way to solve that problem dynamically. I unfortunately do not have time to go into that in detail. I think I'll just leave it at that. Interestingly, a solution to that problem also gives us a good dark matter candidate. So that's why there's a lot of focus on that idea. More generally, in string theory, there are a lot of axion-like particles. They come from Kaluza-Klein modes of higher form fields when you have compactified dimension, extra dimensions. One of them might be the QCD axion, but there are certainly many others. Let me make a footnote though, before I leave this slide, on kind of the ultralight end, why there is an argument that made it kind of sort of interesting to consider as a special case. So let me give you that footnote on the ultralight version. Again, by ultralight, I mean 10 to the minus 22, although as you will see by the end argument, you will see there is actually a pretty wide range even here. This 10 to the minus 22, there is a slope of actually quite a few orders of magnitude, even many more orders of magnitude. Okay, so what is the argument? Once again, the setup is you have this scalar field I call phi. Think of that as the angular field, like in this Mexican head potential, it's an angle. As an angular field, there is a periodicity scale. Remember, phi has mass dimension, so there is an energy scale which defines the periodicity. And I'm going to call this F here, capital F, and is often called the axion decay constant. If this were exactly a Goldstone boson, then there would be no potential of this form. You would have basically this standard kinetic term plus maybe derivative corrections, derivative interactions. However, non-perturbative effects actually often generate potential like this, breaking basically the shift symmetry of the scalar into a discrete symmetry. It's still an angle, so you have this basically this kind of cosine behavior. And by non-perturbative effects, let me be a little bit more specific. Think of these effects as the analog of quantum tunneling. As you know, in quantum tunneling, the amplitude for tunneling is exponentially suppressed, where the exponent goes like some, if you want, instanton action divided by h bar. So if you take h bar go to zero limit, that kind of effect is invisible. So you only see non-perturbatively. So that's what is meant here. In particular, instantons often generate basically this scale, which is called lambda here, which is exponentially suppressed. It can be very small. Hence, the smallness of the mass of this axion, right? And if you take this cosine potential and you expand out and read off the quadratic term, which gives you an m squared phi squared, you can read off the mass of the particle, which is like so. So imagine, so for the sake of basically argument, we are going to imagine this axion decay constant is some high energy scale. This lambda is some exponentially suppressed scale compared to that scale, let's say. That combination could conceivably give you a fairly small mass. So that's kind of the setup. On top of that, there is an argument based on relic abundance that suggests fairly small mass is interesting. And it's come from basically thinking about the abundance left over from the Big Bang. And it's a mechanism often called the misalignment mechanism. And the way it works is something like this. I draw a little cartoon here. This is the potential. So this is basically this whole potential here, drawn here. And we have to make an assumption about where is the scalar field in the early universe. So the primordial value, absent additional information, it seems not unreasonable to assume it's of the order of F. F is basically, again, this periodicity scale. So it's of the order of F. Or in the language of the misalignment mechanism, people will often say the misalignment angle is order one, basically. Phi over F is order one. So that is our starting assumption, right? So this scalar field in the early universe will just be stuck here for a long time because of Hubble friction. It cannot really roll down the potential very effectively until the Hubble expansion rate basically drops to be the mass scale of the particle, basically this curvature scale of the potential. Then the scalar field can roll down the potential and commence oscillations. And the expansion of the universe over time takes energy away from these oscillations. And so after a few EFO, if you want, the oscillation would be fairly close to the minimum of the potential. And in fact, from that point of view, you can even forget about this whole cosine structure. Just think of this as oscillation around m squared phi squared potential. And you can actually check fairly easily that the energy density in these oscillations redshift like matter density, meaning it redshift like 1/volume or 1/ the scale factor to the third power. And from that point of view, this is already a dark matter candidate, if you want. Think of the oscillations as basically a set of particles. Now, if you follow this argument, I skip the math here, you can actually compute the relic abundance. The omega in these axion particles today would be of the order of what you might want for dark matter. If you make two assumptions, one is the axion decay constant is rather large. Here I chose 10 to the 17 GeV, somewhere between gut scale, close to Planck scale. And if the mass is actually fairly light, this ultra-light value 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. That being said, let me emphasize the relic abundance is in fact more sensitive to your assumption about F because it goes by F squared than your assumption about M because it's square root of M. So if your axion decay constant turns out to be just a little bit different, you know, to match the dark matter abundance, your mass would be very different from 10 to the minus 22. So please keep that in mind, right? Nonetheless, this argument suggests there's some reason to think about a fairly light particle as dark matter. It seems to fairly, at least in a very simple model, give you the correct abundance for dark matter. So that's kind of the motivation. And I think I'll just leave it as that for the particle physics motivation.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please do.
You know, from the fundamental theory, you mentioned where lambda is coming from, it's the instantaneous suppression. So what is F coming from? What sets the set, you know, from the fundamental instantaneous calculation? What is F?
Yeah, so F is the axion decay constant. In the context of the axion, it basically has to do with the breaking of the Petri Quinn symmetry. So think of this masculine half potential. No,
is it tunable or it's related to an action or is it something?
Yeah. So if you think about this masculine half potential, of course phi equals zero is really the symmetric point, but the potential minima are actually breaking this UN symmetry. You pick one of the points along this circle. The associated symmetry breaking scale, if you want, is what F is. I'm not sure if that is a useful answer to you.
So in QCD, for instance, when you have a QCD axion, is that an extra choice you have, or what?
Yeah, in fact, we do not know, right? For the QCD axion, how big is F? There are astrophysical constraints. Basically, we know F cannot be too small, because if it's too small, we already know, for example, you would cool down stars by too much by emitting axions and so on. So there is a lower bound on F, something of the order of maybe, if I remember correctly, maybe 10 to the 12 GeV, something like that. But beyond that, we don't really know precisely what is the value. It's unknown, actually. The value I pick here, 10 to the 17 GeV, that 10 seems to be the value that occurs in a lot of string theory constructions. So it's taken from this paper. But yeah, it's something we are very ignorant about, precisely what is the scale at. Are there other questions? And this value F would show again towards the end of the talk, because it really determines the strength of the interaction of dark matter with the standard model, of the axion with the standard model. So it's going to show up again. But in this context, it shows up because it affects the Rayleigh abundance. Yeah. Are there other questions?
Lam, this is, yeah. Latham. Hi. Do you know if the string theory examples of axions, are there examples where they also solve the QCD, the strong CP problem, or are those sort of, should I think of those as two different classes of axions?
Certainly string theory allows for, you know, of the many possible axions, one of them could be the QCD axions. I think that is entirely possible. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Although in a lot of these string theory constructions, the way the axion get their mass is from some kind of instantons that are generally, you know, in a lot of these cases, they have nothing to do with the QCD phase transition. But one of them could be the QCD axion. Yeah. Okay, thank you for your questions. Please keep interrupting me. Let me tell you about the dynamics. In fact, the dynamics is incredibly simple, because as we discussed here in this argument, after a few expansion time scale, the axion is really oscillating around the minimum. So you have just basically the good old Klein-Gordon equation that describes the dynamics. This is the Klein-Gordon equation for the scalar. You can ignore self-interaction for the scalar because you are oscillating close to the minimum. We for structure formation, we are interested in the non-relativistic regime, right? Remember the velocity dispersion I quoted earlier is like, you know, 200 kilometers per second. So it's quite a bit smaller than the speed of light. So we are interested in non-relativistic regime, and it's a fairly standard thing to do to rewrite your axion field, which is a real scalar, replace that actually by a complex scalar psi, where what you do is you factor out the primary time dependence. The frequency m here follows from just the mass of the particle. Your phi field should oscillate with that frequency. That's pretty easy to see. You do allow the psi, the complex scalar, to have some time dependence, but the assumption is that time dependence is weak. It turns out you can show that it's precisely what you want in the non-relativistic regime, that the time dependence for psi is much slower than this frequency M oscillation, essentially. And then you add the complex conjugate to make sure you have a real field phi. From that, you actually deduce from the Klein-Gordon equation, the good old Schrödinger equation, where I do include one interaction that is important for us, and is the gravitational interaction. So this is the gravitational potential, and I should have added an extra equation. So this is the Schrödinger equation. In the presence of some gravitational potential, I should have added a second equation that tells you what generates that gravitational potential, and it's very easy. It's just a Poisson equation. meaning if you take Laplacian of phi, the gravitational potential is sourced by basically the density of these particle size. So you basically do psi square, that give you the mass, the number density. You multiply by m, that give you the mass density, and that sources your gravitational potential. And that's it. The dynamics is just these two equations, the Schrödinger equation plus the Poisson equation. Okay. And let me emphasize here that it sometimes is a source of some confusion. Here, despite the appearance of the Schrödinger equation, this field psi is really a classical scalar. It's a complex classical scalar, but it's a classical scalar. And I use the term classical in a way that's just very similar to the way you might think about classical E&M. You know, when you are in a situation with many photons, in many cases, the classical electric magnetic field is a very good description of what's going on. Here, likewise, the same is true. Our psi describe a state where there are many, many particles in the Broglie volume. So we are basically talking about the same kind of classical wave. So it's a classical wave, despite the fact that it's a Schrödinger equation. Okay. And here I want to also introduce kind of an alternative point of view, which is sometimes useful, is to think of this wave function. I'm going to continue to call this the wave function, even though this is classical. This wave function can also alternatively be thought of as a fluid. And as a fluid, what do I mean? First of all, I already told you the density rho goes like psi square. That's fairly natural. This complex scalar has a phase, of course. The phase turns out, in this formulation, you want to identify as the velocity potential. So the velocity of the fluid goes like the gradient of the phase. And one way to kind of see why you might want to do that is to think about mass conservation, which you must have for your fluid. If this is a good fluid, it must respect mass conservation. And it's fairly easy to convince yourself, this mass conservation is just a different way of saying what is might be more familiar to you in the context of Schrödinger equation. You know there is probability conservation, right? And the mass conservation is just a recasting of that. So the probability conservation that you are familiar with now is recast as the mass conservation for the fluid. And then you can see the fluid velocity must be interpreted this way. As such, this is some kind of superfluid if you want. The velocity is pure gradient flow. And we will have more to say about that in a moment. The Schrödinger equation is complex, so there really should be two real equations hidden in there. Mass conservation is one. The other equation is the Euler equation that you are familiar with in fluid mechanics. Most of the terms here are familiar. This is basically acceleration, and this is acceleration due to gravity, gradient of the gravitational potential. This term might be unfamiliar looking to some of you. This term is really describe the wave effects. And this term is often called quantum pressure in the literature. And I'm going to continue to use that term, even though it's a little bit misleading. This term actually does not arrive from pressure alone. It arrives from some non-trivial gradient or divergence of a stress tensor. The stress tensor has off-diagonal components. Okay, but written this way, it also makes it very easy to see in what sense you can recover conventional cold dark matter. Conventional cold dark matter, I mean basically particle dark matter as opposed to wave dark matter. You just take the high mass limit. In the high M limit, this becomes very small. And then the rest of the terms of this equation are the familiar equation that we use all the time to describe conventional cold dark matter or particle cold dark matter in the structure formation, okay? Are there any questions at this point? Okay. So here I'm just appealing to authority. Let me just skip this. So this is Feynman lectures. You can read Feynman Lectures Volume 3 to see what he had to say about thinking about psi, describing a classical system. In fact, in the same chapter, you can find actually this quantum pressure there also. Let me skip that. Let me actually start discussing what does it mean? What are the phenomenologies? What are the interesting effects? And one interesting effect is you can actually see already in this snapshot of a simulation, which was done by Xinyu Li here. And I'm just going to play the movie and I'll explain. This is not really a movie. This is actually taking a simulation box at a particular moment in time and just taking slices of it. It's just a way to show you the three-dimensional structure. And I hope it's fairly obvious. You see interference fringes, no? And it's really because of the wave nature of the dark matter. The fact that you see constructive and destructive interference, the color coding here is basically density. The low density regions are basically the dark parts. So you see interference patterns along filaments. You see interference patterns around halos. If you zoom in, you even see interference pattern inside halos. So they are there and is an inevitable consequence of having waves. In other words, think of a halo like this one as consists of a superposition of many components of waves, and you superimpose them. These are waves at different energy or different momenta. And these waves have sort of like random phases inside the halo. And if you add them all up and you square it, you find interference. It's a very generic prediction. And a lot of this talk will be about what this means for phenomenology. And there are many interesting effects that one could talk about. I'm going to focus on something, a few topics that are relatively recent for us, things that we have done recently. I think for most of the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on talking about vortices or domain walls, topological defects, basically, in this superfluid, if you want. I don't think I have time to talk about black hole accretion or soliton condensation and oscillations. You can ask me about that if you want towards the end. Neil, can you give me a sense how much time am I doing in time?
Oh, yeah. Well, we started, I guess, like a few minutes late. So I guess maybe like a bit less than half an hour.
Ah, okay. Great. Fantastic. We might even be able to talk about some of these. Let's see. Vortices. So let me just pause here before I start talking about some of these phenomena in case there are questions. Okay, so let's talk about vortices, no? At first, you might actually wonder why am I even talking about vorticity? Because I already told you, in the fluid formulation, velocity goes like gradient of the phase. So the velocity is clearly purely gradient flow. So if I take the curl of it, I should get zero. There should be no vorticity. That is, of course, correct, except for one loophole. And the loophole turns out to be a very interesting one. Think about this waves sloshing around in your halo. And occasionally there will be destructive interference. And occasionally, just by chance, the destructive interference could be extreme, meaning it's complete. The density actually go all the way to zero, let's say. Those places turn out to be very interesting and special. Those are places where if you look at this decomposition of the complex scalar, this wave function, rho shows up in the amplitude. So if the amplitude is zero, in fact, the phase is actually ill-defined. So there is something about this fluid formulation that actually breaks down precisely at locations where rho or the wave function itself vanishes. Again, these are places where you have complete destructive interference. You can already see that even in the quantum pressure term, though. If you send rho to zero, somehow something bad happens. And we are going to exploit that. In fact, we want to investigate. Now, before we investigate that, a very natural question you might have is, isn't that actually fairly academic? These places where you have complete destructive interference, that rho is equal to zero, isn't it very rare? I'm going to postpone the answer to that question a little bit, but you will see, in fact, it's not rare at all. It happens all the time. It's actually ubiquitous. Let me also add a comment, which is what I try to say here. And this is an important point. You know, in this kind of wave dark matter, of course, you have interference phenomenon throughout the history of the universe. But the interference phenomenon do not give you dramatic things like complete destructive interference, not in the early universe. Because in the early universe, you might recall, the universe is roughly homogeneous with very small fluctuation, 10 to the minus 5. So even as you superimpose those waves, you can never get the density going all the way to zero. It's just impossible because the fluctuation is too small. What happens here is that if you wait, these fluctuations grow with time, basically under gravitational collapse. And when the fluctuations become order one in size, in amplitude, or even bigger, then complete destructive interference can actually happen. So it's a distinctively nonlinear phenomenon, if you want, in this cosmological context. And it happens because of gravity. Gravity amplifies the fluctuations. So that's an important point. And before I elaborate a little bit on these locations of rho equals zero, which are, turns out to be vortices, let me also say this phenomenon of vortices is, of course, fairly well understood in condensed matter physics. These are really analog vortices in superfluids. So I should acknowledge that. The only novelty I think we could claim is here we have a context in which you have a fluid, superfluid with no vortices at the beginning. In the early universe, no, because again, the fluctuations were too small to have complete destructive interference, but somehow gravity is sufficient to do the work. Okay, so let me now kind of zoom in. Let's just imagine somewhere in your halo, there is a point where rho is just zero, which also means the wave function is zero. The wave function vanished at that point. Let's just analyze what happened in the neighborhood of that point, okay? And it's going to be a fairly simple Taylor expansion argument. And to make it as simple as possible, I'm going to do this in one spatial dimension at first. So imagine your wave function is a function of x, the one spatial dimension. And imagine x equals zero is where the wave function vanishes, just by chance, yeah? By chance, destructive interference, psi at x equals zero vanishes. Well, then let's look at the next term in the Taylor expansion, no? And let's assume the first gradient does not vanish. And so you are dominated by this term in the neighborhood of the origin. And here I sketch out for you, it's a little bit pedantic, but I want to make sure we are all on the same page. So this is the complex plane of the wave function, the real part and the imaginary part. Imagine in your head that you move from x negative, crosses zero, and going over to positive. Just imagine you do that. Then this complex wave function would probably sketch out this blue arrow, no? This blue arrow is basically the first gradient of the of psi. Your psi probably has the values over here. At this point, it vanishes at x equals zero, and then it emerges on the other side. What is interesting is to ask what happens to the phase, and you can see the phase go from here to here with a pi jump. So if you actually plot the phase, it looks something like this. The phase as a function of x has a pi jump, and it's just a very simple consequence of this Taylor expansion. And this is, if you want, is our kind of very basic domain wall. It's a wall defining the phase, it's a jump in the phase. Yeah, and it's just a consequence of the fact that wave function just happens to vanish at the origin. Okay, of course we are interested in not one spatial dimension, but three spatial dimensions, yeah? How should we think about that? First, let's remember, we are interested in locations where the wave function, both the real and the imaginary part vanish. if you are in three spatial dimension and you ask yourself, where are the set of points where the real part of the wave function could vanish, you will probably span a surface. Yeah. And if you ask are the set of points where the imaginary part of the wave function vanish in three dimension, well, it will be under the surface. And where they cross is where both vanish. And you can see generically, it will be a line, no? And you can also convince yourself somehow this line cannot end. It's more like magnetic field. Somehow it should close. And so you should actually find something like a ring, basically. And now if you run this Taylor expansion argument, generalized to 3D, is essentially just put arrow on top of everything. Yeah, just put arrow here. And pictorially, I draw basically this one segment of this vortex ring, the purple line. And I ask myself, how does the phase of this wave function behave if I loop around this line segment? You can convince yourself the phase must wind by integers of 2 pi, yeah? So this is what I said here, integers of 2 pi. In general, this n is some integer. It can be positive, it can be negative. When do you have a higher winding, meaning n is not 1 or negative 1? Those happens actually only rarely. Those happens basically when the first gradient happens to vanish and you have to go to higher order. In the Taylor expansion, then you will have higher winding. If you're dominant by this, you can convince yourself you have n equals plus 1 or minus 1. And if you think about the fluid formulation where the velocity is the gradient of the phase, the fact that the phase wraps around also means your fluid velocity have non-zero circulation. So if you integrate your fluid velocity around a loop, it is quantized in this particular way, where n again is this integer winding. And you can actually make a few more statements just based on this simple Taylor expansion argument. The fact that the wave function is linear in separation x means the density, which is size square, would be the distance square. That's why I say rho goes like r square. You have an n here because if you have a higher winding, then you have to rely on higher terms in the Taylor expansion. If n is equal to 1, it's just r square, just based on squaring this. Moreover, if the velocity have this circulation, the size of the loop, of course, scale with r. So it's basically telling you velocity scale like 1 over r. So these are actually fairly generic predictions. And to have these very generic predictions is useful if you can imagine if we want to think about ways to look for these things. These are very generic behavior. And let me emphasize before I leave this slide that these are topological defects, but they are not the axion strings. For those of you who are familiar with axion, these are not the axion strings that are familiar when people think about QCD axion, for example. There, the U1 associated with the axion string is the Petri-Quinn U1. Here, this U1 actually is more mundane. It's just the U1 of the wave function. In other words, it's the U1 associated with particle number conservation when you are in the non-relativistic regime. Okay. Any questions before I move on? I think this is probably the most elaborate argument I have in this talk. The rest, I hope it's pretty obvious. Any questions? Very good. Neil, can you give me an update on the time? How much time do I have?
Let's see, maybe like 15 minutes.
15 minutes, okay, great. Fantastic. Okay, so once you know, realize these are fairly general arguments for vortices, then it comes back to the question we had at the beginning. Well, this all sound nice and cute, but shouldn't these things be very rare? Because these occur by, you know, complete destructive interference, just by chance. Shouldn't that be very rare? Well, then the thing to do is to actually look for these things in a simulation. In a simulation of halos that form from basically gravitational collapse. This is one zoom in snapshot of a particular halo. This blue circle here might be what you might want to call a candidate vortex ring. The blue color means very low density. And I emphasize the term candidate because, you know, in a simulation, one should be very careful in identifying vortex ring just based on density, because the density in a simulation never exactly vanish, right? Numerically, you might have small values, but it would never be exactly zero. And so the way to actually be very sure you actually have a topological defect is in fact not to look at the density, but look at the phase and make sure it actually winds around this object. And indeed you can check that and find basically these rings. This is a plot of the phase. I'm going to just skip this because it might be a little bit hard to read. Suffice to say, you can find these objects. This is one example of a halo where these are the vortex rings. They look very nice and symmetric because this halo is actually very symmetric. If you have more messy initial conditions, the topological defects looks more deformed. It looks more like this. And you can check simple things like density profile that I told you about. It should scale like R square. That checks out. The velocity should go like 1 over R close to the rings, and it checks out. To gain intuition, in fact, it's helpful to think of very simple-minded analytic solutions. I wrote down a few. And this analytic solution, you can actually invent yourself very easily by turning off gravity. Because if you turn off gravity, you just have linear Schrödinger equation. And you can just ask yourself, can I build solutions where psi actually vanish around a ring? And there are all kinds of solutions like that. These are not particularly physical solutions because, as you can see, for example, this one, which is just a vortex line extending along the z-axis. They blow up far away. So these are not particularly physical, but it's good for getting intuition. And you can find solutions where vortex ring nucleate from very small size, expand, and then contract and disappear, going to basically some very small size. And you can investigate what happens when they cross and so on. I'm going to skip that. If you look at the motion of a ring, this is kind of the generic behavior. This is a vortex ring. You have sort of non-zero circulation going around this way or going around this way. And it turns out on top of this circulation, the whole ring itself should move, and it moves with a velocity, goes like 1 over the radius of the ring. And let me skip this. Let me just make some kind of qualitative comments. The first is the question I asked earlier, right? Should defects be rare? It turns out they are not rare. We can even quantify. Roughly, statistically, you should expect one vortex ring per the Brodie volume, okay? And it turns out you can show this both by just brute force, looking at the simulations and counting them, or you can actually compute this analytically, at least for some simple halo model. A very simple model, actually, which is very useful to keep in mind, is a model where you have waves with random phases and a momentum distribution or velocity dispersion that is basically Gaussian. And you can just compute what is the expectation for the number density of these defects. For those of you who have done this kind of thing in large-scale structure, this is very analogous to computing peaks in Gaussian random field, except here you're looking at zero crossing, and you can find basically one defect per the Brodie volume, that kind of prediction. So they are not rare, they are ubiquitous. I said that earlier, small rings move faster, or more generally, if you have some kind of vortex loops, the segments that are curved, they are more curved, they also move faster. Third bullet point, I want to emphasize these vortices, they are transient phenomena. In the sense that these vortices, of course, they move around. They also come and go, but they cannot come and go arbitrarily. Because if you remember, there is a fluid interpretation away from the vortices, which means this fluid actually respects Kelvin's theorem. The circulation cannot just disappear. So these vortices have actually some integrity to it. Once they are there, they actually hang on, they move around with on some time scale, and the time scale can be very easily estimated, especially the Broglie time. Take the Broglie wavelength divided by the, again, the typical velocity in your fluid. If you plug in numbers for ultralight, 10 to the minus 22 electron volts, this time scale is actually fairly long, millions of years. So these vortices in the ultralight regime, they really stick around for quite a while. The only way they can disappear is for a vortex loop, for example, to shrink to basically very small size, basically shrink to a point, and then you can disappear. Otherwise, you cannot just have a vortex ring that is extended inside and just suddenly disappear. That's impossible, basically, by Kelvin's theorem. There is some interesting statement one could make about angular momentum. I think I'll skip that. Suffice to say, even if you have a halo that has no net angular momentum, these vortex rings still exist. They are just there because of statistics. Statistically, they are there, again, at the range of one per the Broglie volume. It's impossible to avoid.
Lam?
Yeah.
If you have two rings that get close, do they repel each other or can they intersect?
They can intersect, yeah.
And yeah. Then when they do that, do they typically pass through, or do they recombine?
Yeah, they basically if you intersect through this way, then they would form basically this. What would you call that process? You know, they would pinch off basically.
Uh huh.
You can actually check them very easily by looking at this solution. Look at this solution, which you can write down very easily, and you ask yourself what happens. From T negative to T positive, you can check. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Very nice. Should I go over this? I think I'm going to skip this part. You can actually measure the probability of density, and the density fluctuates basically because of interference. And it has this kind of distribution in the simulations. And the thing I want to emphasize is this density actually peaks at very low density, which is precisely where you have destructive interference. Yeah, so it's not rare at all. And in fact, you can actually try to understand this measure from the simulation, again, from a very simple halo model of random phase, which is this dashed line. I'm gonna skip the details of that. Let me end with some thoughts about, you know, observation and experiments, no? Hopefully, I have a few minutes left, and you.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so in terms of observational signatures, I have to confess, it's not so easy to find signatures where you can really isolate one vortex ring. The most promising signatures that we could actually identify is not so much from one single vortex ring, but it's more from the superposition of many interference substructures or the Broglie blobs. And let me just highlight this one particular one. And this is something that is an approach which is really pioneered by Neil himself. It's a phenomenon called a flux anomaly. And the idea is very simple. If you have lens gravitational lensing events where the two images, for example, these two stars are very close to each other, which actually means they are very highly magnified. In particular, they straddle this what is called a critical line. If the lensing potential is smooth, you can convince yourself based on very generic arguments, basically a Taylor expansion argument again, that the magnification should be equal for these two images. Observationally, people often find the magnifications are not identical. There's some small difference. And what could give rise to that small difference? Well, that difference could be due to substructure. If you have substructure in the halo that is on the scale of the image separation or smaller, it could preferentially magnify one image over another, right? So it's a way, if you want, to identify departure of the lensing halo from just a very simple, smooth halo. And one form of substructure is basically these interference fringes, if you want. And we plug in some numbers. This is the number we got. If you look at cases that are fairly extreme, the magnification is 100 or above, you can find flux anomaly at the 10% level, basically relative magnification at the 10% level. And here I just give you an example. It's basically a cluster example from this paper by Lam Dai. There are other possible things that you could look for example, heating of tidal streams is something that we have been thinking about with Xinyu and with Neil. Can tell you more about that later on. I want to actually wrap up since I think I'm running out of time by talking about experiments. So these astrophysical signatures is for the ultralight regime, right? Close to 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. Let me talk about a little bit about experiments. Suppose you are interested in dark matter that's light but not ultralight. For example, QCD axion. So there, the Broglie wave thing is of course a lot smaller. And therefore it's very hard to see this kind of interference pattern with astrophysical observations. But direct detection experiments, like QCD axion detection experiment, they can measure very small scale. And so they would be sensitive to this wave structure. And without giving a long introduction, the typical experiment makes use of one of two interactions. One is the axion coupled to FF duo of the photon, or if you want, E dot B of the photon. The F here is the same F that I called earlier. I think I called it capital F, the axion decay constant, okay? The other interaction is a derivative interaction of the axion to basically the fermions. If you, and psi can be, you know, the fermion, meaning that lepton or quarks. Essentially, this coupling is a coupling of the gradient of the axion to the spin, basically, the spin of this particle. So there are experiments that make use of either one coupling or the other. The second coupling, basically people look for precession of spins in within the context that the axion actually have some gradient, which is very natural because the axion is probably moving through our environment or we are moving through the axion fluid. And then the spin should precess. So there are experiments that look for that. Here, all I want to say is different experiments basically measure different things about the axion field, either this axion field or derivatives thereof. Okay, but now I want to focus on what this wave kind of interference substructure means for these experiments, okay? And for that, let me remind you, right? The axion field is this one. The wave function, the complex wave function I talked about earlier is this one. Remember, this has slow time variation. The fast time variation is the oscillation at frequency m, the mass of the axion. If you have a detector at a particular location and you plot the time series of the axion field, probably looks something like this. You have rapid oscillation at frequency, which is basically m, yeah? You would have longer time scale modulation, which is basically the de Broglie time, which is longer. Here I give numbers that are for m, which is 10 to the minus 6 electron volts. You can scale it up and down as you wish. Suffice to say, in a lot of these experiments, they are sensitive to both time scales. They see both. And what I want to suggest is that in this way of thinking about the halo as actually very inhomogeneous, in particular, you have many wave components with random phases, the axion is really like a stochastic field. And really, you should think of these experiments as measuring basically correlation functions. I think that's probably the last scale structural way to think about it. They are fluctuations in time, so you can measure time correlation functions. You can also measure spatial correlation functions if you have detectors in different locations. In fact, probably I think the a good way to think about this is to have a network of detectors where you measure correlation function of the axion field, much rather like what you would do in radio interferometry. Let me say, at the vortices, psi is zero, so the axion is zero, but you can also convince yourself the gradient is not. So if vortices pass through your detectors, it actually means different things for different experiments. Some experiments will see zero signal, some experiments will not. And I just want to leave you with kind of an interesting thought, right? This whole argument about having this vortex structure tells you that there is some non-trivial spatial structure in the phase, and it's the phase of this wave function, which now understood in terms of the axion field is actually a phase in the oscillation of the axion. Somehow this has actually interesting spatial structure, and it would be interesting to just think about, you know, knowing that, can we devise measurements, for example, correlation function measurements that help us actually probe this kind of structure, maybe even more optimistically try to use this to enhance our signal to noise, to get poor signal out of noisy data. So that's a thought I want to leave it with you. It's something that we are actively thinking about. I think I'm out of time, so I'm gonna skip the part about black hole and soliton oscillations. Let me conclude, right? So I think I had time to talk about the first bullet point. And I want to just leave you with the idea that if dark matter were a particle, in particular, like an axion or axion-like particle, lighter than 30 electron volts, wave phenomena are basically unavoidable, in particular interference. And in fact, there are many possible implications, one of which is vortices, but there are actually many. And there's quite a lot to explore, actually. And I'll leave it as that. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Lam. Associative Ram, associative him a round of applause.
Thank you.
And then let's see, we have maybe time for like a couple of questions. So are there any further questions for Lam? I can maybe start just by asking about this interesting thing you mentioned about black hole accretion. Is it possible to, is it possible just to comment on that, like, briefly?
Yeah, let me show you. I'll just comment on that by showing you a movie. hopefully that doesn't freeze the screen. So this is, what am I doing here? If I want to think about this axion around a black hole, and let's say the geometry is completely determined by the black hole, so the gravitational effects of the axion is a minor effect, then what you want to do is you want to solve the Klein-Gordon equation in the black hole background. In this case, I just saw it for Schwarzschild, but you can do it for Kerr as well. And you don't want to use the Schrödinger description anymore because the scalar field or the axion does get relativistic when it gets close to the horizon. So you want to solve the Klein-Gordon equation, but it's a very well-defined problem in that people have solved this for many, many years. I would just want to show you a movie. The question is, what is the boundary condition? The boundary condition is the following. So on this x-axis, this radius, far away, your axion basically just oscillate up and down, no? With frequency m. That's what this m there is for. What that does is it will set up waves that would travel towards the horizon. The horizon is to the far left. This R star is basically the tortoise coordinate. If you want R star equals zero, you are at a field Schwarzschild radius, somewhere close. And let me just play the movie, you know? As the axion oscillate, it set of waves, the waves basically travel into the black hole, and you can see the waves actually get amplified. And the amplification is something that can be understood in actually a fairly simple way. There's a power of the scalar that you can understand. The precise behavior depends on actually more or less just one number. It's the ratio of the Compton wavelength of the axion to the horizon size. Depending on that number, you can have wave that just travels straight in with some amplification, or you can have some amount of that reflected back. You have some kind of standing wave pattern. And so you can investigate basically if you want, what is the accretion profile of the dark matter around a black hole? And you can deduce things like what is M dot, and for example, and so on. Yeah.
Okay, I see. But this is distinct from the super radiance, I guess, effects that people have talked about.
Yeah, this is distinct from the super radiance, right? The super radiance is, if you want, is really the super radiance cloud is kind of a bound cloud around the black hole. And as you know, that cloud has certain levels that are unstable and grow with time and extract spin from the black hole. This is something different. This is something saying, well, if you have dark matter in the environment, the dark matter cannot help but accrete onto the black hole, if you want. And if you ask what are the super radiance constraints in the literature on the existence of light scalar, very often those computations assume your super radiance cloud basically grow from a very small seed to some big size that extract angular momentum from the black hole. If the scalar is actually dark matter, then one might have to revisit those calculations because the scalar field is there all the time from the beginning. So it's an interesting thing. That's kind of part of our motivation for doing this calculation. Yeah.
Okay, great, thanks. You know, in the interest of time, maybe let's stop here because we are 10 minutes past.
Okay.
So we can stop the recording.